Thank you. It's always good to get applause before you start, because you don't know how good I'm going to be, so get that out of the way first. I'm glad you've been having an enjoyable time at the conference. We can soon put a stop to that, because we need to talk about some regulations, some accounting standards, and we need to run through some topical issues. So what do you talk about in only an hour and a quarter that is hopefully practical and relevant to a large number of you? Well, I've picked some topics there. It's going to be a little bit tight for time, I think, to get through all of them, but we'll see how it goes. If I do have to skip anything, we've tried to make the notes that you've got. I think they're probably bigger than most people do, but I always think, well, give you good value in the notes. That'll give you a bit of a workout carrying them around. But if there's anything I have to skip over, then you should have quite a lot of detail in the notes. And I don't know about questions. If you've got a burning question, then by all means butt in. But I'm not in a hurry to go at 3 o'clock. So if you want to catch me during the coffee break, I'll be happy to take any questions on a one-to-one basis. I haven't got any more notes personally, but though there's a couple at the front, there's a few people with hands up. Need some notes. Fantastic. So we're going to start a little bit with audit exemption. I appreciate that it's unlikely there are any auditors here, but clearly you act for small companies. That's why you're listening to me this afternoon. And so it'd be good just to run through when you need an audit so that you can watch out for when one of your clients might need an audit. And it's worth bearing in mind that there are a number of firms, both chartered and certified and unqualified, who are deliberately going out, searching the company's house register, looking for companies that should have had an audit, or conversely didn't need an audit, and then writing to the registered office saying, "Oi, did you know you should have had an audit? Your accountant is clearly negligent. Come to me for the accounts and the tax and everything else." And conversely, sometimes we're getting firms writing to those that don't need an audit, but I guess have chosen for it. And they're writing to those registered offices saying, "Hey, you don't need an audit. Do you know that we could do it for half the price? We could do your accounts and tax probably for half the price of this firm." And so if you know when there needs to be an audit, then clearly you can do something about it. You could do some marketing. You could have a look at company's house register. And if one of your clients needs an audit, then why not get on board with a firm of auditors and let them do the audit while you retain anything else? I've got a couple of firms in these difficult times, and it's a firm of AAT and a qualified chartered firm, and they're now doing joint quotes because the chartered firm is going, "We could do with some more audits. We pay for our manual, we pay for CPD. Why don't we just do some audits?" And the AAT firm is saying, "Well, hey, we could just do with some more work generally, but we don't do audits." And they've said, "Okay, well, to increase our attack, whenever we quote for work, one of them will quote for the accounts, the other will quote for the audit." And they reckon they've got a nice thing going. They think that they'll be able to get between 20 and 40 audits in the next 12 months because of the interest they've had in this approach. Hey, we are independent, we're separate, you can get the best accounts and tax advice over here, you can get the best audit over here, and they're probably cheaper than, say, a larger regional firm. So there are opportunities to be had from knowing when the audit limits cut in. Certainly, if you're a chartered firm, you will have been looking at that comment thinking, "Oh, goodness, the Institute of Chartered Accountants take a very dim view when someone doesn't have an audit when they should have done." So what that says to me is clearly there are a number of professional firms, so there's probably some people here who aren't comfortable in how the rules operate. So we wanted to just run through some examples for you. You've got the limits on page 4 of your notes for a single company and then a group net and gross. And the small company and the audit thresholds work together. They use some of the same numbers, but they use them differently. It drives me nuts when you see headlines like, audit threshold gone up to 6.5 million. It's the same as the small company limit. I think, well, it's the same numbers, but it works differently. It's like all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order, because they operate differently. So if I'm thinking about small status, I've been looking at the table on page 4, say for a standalone company. For small, I need to satisfy 2 out of 3. And certainly if I'm dropping down from medium to small, I need to satisfy 2 out of 3, 2 years running. So small, you don't have to do all three, you have to do 2 out of 3. For audit, you must hit turnover and gross assets in the year. So it's different. So once we are small, we've satisfied 2 out of 3, 2 years running. Then have we satisfied turnover and gross assets? So there are two different tests. I won't dwell on it. I think that we've put a couple of slides in it. But in your notes, you have a great example of a client file we heard about where the company breached the audit threshold. The previous accountant, a lawyer, company's house, you know, they were all convinced that it doesn't need an audit because it's small. And you have to say, no, small is only the first part. Part two is, do you satisfy turnover? Do you satisfy gross assets? I may have said it enough, but it's surprising how many times I go to firms and they still go, gross assets, is that the figure at the bottom of the balance sheet? Now, you're all accountants. What does it say at the bottom of the balance sheet? Net assets. The two are different. That's not a typo. And in some of the reference books, you'll see they use the phrase balance sheet total. I hate the phrase balance sheet total because gross assets is not a total in the balance sheet. You have to add two numbers. Now, you're, you know, qualified, competent people. You can add two numbers together, but you cannot just get you or your staff to look at one number and say, have they met this threshold? So do be careful. So I had a client just before the end of the year. Company took out a load of assets on HP. They really got a lot of assets. It was sort of hundreds of thousands of retooling or whatever you do. And they thought, well, you know, the company's not grown per se. There's no more trading. We don't need to worry about audit. I don't think it really crossed their mind. And you might say common sense would say, no, it doesn't make any difference to the size of the audit. But suddenly they had a massive amount of gross assets. No more net assets, debit assets, credit HP. I'm a trainer, I can do that kind of double entry. But no change to gross assets, but no change to net assets, a massive change to gross assets. Bang, it should have been an audit. If the Institute find it, I know you're not Institute members, but gloat in what other people have to put up with. I think that firm had a £1,000 fine. And then in our monthly magazine, if you are caught by the disciplinary committee, you get what we call an honourable mention. I suppose a dishonourable mention perhaps would be better. So that's point number one. Of course, there are also group things to think about. If you are part of a group, you must think about the group. Now, I know perhaps many of you won't act for groups, but you might have a client come to you or a larger group come to you and say, look, can you audit this one? Because it's local in Bristol, whereas can you act for this one? It's local in Bristol. The rest of the group is in other places. You need to check what's happening with the rest of the group. How big is the rest of the group? Because if the group is medium or large, every company in the group needs an audit. So you'd have to say, sorry, I can't, you know, did you know this company needs an audit because its group is medium or large or fails the thresholds. It might even be that the parent company you're asked to act for because the parent company looks tiny. The parent company is as big as the group. If you've got a medium-sized group, you've got a medium-sized parent. So you just need to be a little careful. You don't take on work and actually you can't do it. So we've got the limits on the slides there. If you do ever have groups, so it's possible you have a small group, then there are gross and net limits. The gross and net limits are gross or net of intercompany transactions. And you can literally pick and choose whatever you want. So if you've got a group, to make sure they're small and audit exempt, you could have gross turnover. You could try net gross assets, if that makes any sense. So you can pick and choose which level you want. Someone said to me, what happens if I haven't got any intercompany transactions? It doesn't matter. You can still try these limits, even if the deduction for intercompany transactions would be nil. Of course, I'm sure we're all aware you've got to make sure you haven't got any ineligible companies in the group because they would make the whole group ineligible. So again, I often say to my clients when they're acting for a subsidiary, I say, oh, we don't need to audit, David. It's just a small subsidiary of a group. The directors asked us to audit it. I said, okay, is any of the rest of the group a banking company? Is it listed outside the EEA? Is it involved in transactions under the Financial Services and Markets Act? They go, I don't know. We weren't asked. We didn't ask what was in the rest of the group. I said, uh-oh, you must know what the rest of the group does so that you can decide whether you can prepare small audit-exempt company accounts. As a slight aside, I suppose, you know, like all us chartered, you're covered by the money laundering regulations. I always find it hard when a firm says, we've got a subsidiary, you know, we're not totally sure who the ultimate parent is. And I'll say, well, how have you done your money laundering? How can you possibly identify the beneficial owners if you don't know who they are? So I'd be really concerned if you've got subsidiaries of groups where you don't know what's in the group, you don't know the parent company, you don't know who owns the parent company. Okay, I think let's push on a little bit then. So we've talked about the audit exemption criteria. What's not on the slides, which I thought it might be worth mentioning, is kind of rumbling on in the press at the moment, and we'll see what happens, which is perhaps an opportunity for you to get some more clients. There's a lot of debate that it's too restrictive, the current audit exemption criteria, because you can imagine, I've said it's gross assets, and it's often the gross assets that causes a problem. So a lot of property investment companies I see, they get caught, tiny turnover, but because you've got to revalue the assets, you get these massive gross asset figures. There's consultation at the moment. It seems that in Europe, they're quite happy that as long as it's small, it's audit exempt. And they're saying that will potentially open up the floodgates to quite a lot of these property investment companies to suddenly become audit exempt, which, as you're not auditors, most of you, that's potentially an awful lot of clients you could start writing to and say, hey, why don't you come and try something cheaper than a chartered accountant or something better than an unqualified? You know, there must be opportunity for these. There's also talk the limits will go up. Current proposals are 10 million euros. Whatever that translates at, probably about £8 million, and then gross assets of about £4 million, depending on when they translate it. So it's likely, and it may even be announced this October, you'll see a change in the way that audit exemption is done, so it will become 2 out of 3, and you'll see an increase in the thresholds to €10 million and €5 million, whatever that translates to. There is also another proposal that as long as the parent company guarantees the debts of the subsidiary, that the subsidiary will be audit exempt. And that's perhaps another potential opportunity. So you could start acting for subsidiaries of groups. Well, they don't need an audit because the parent says it's okay, these entities will guarantee their debts. I'm not sure how many parent companies will do that. Because what's the point of having a subsidiary and guaranteeing the debts? Seems the point of a subsidiary is to get some limitation of liability. But perhaps there's an opportunity. And I suppose the cynic in me says it could be possible if one of your clients has a big company, could they split it into a group, guarantee the debts of the subsidiaries, and what's left doesn't need an audit? Perhaps. We'll have to see what happens to the rules, but it's definitely worth keeping an eye on. If you do make a mistake, what should you do? Well, I think you have to tell the client. You know, ultimately, it's the director's responsibility. They've breached their duties under the Companies Act because they haven't appointed an auditor. Okay, then it's perhaps your fault for not telling them, but you've got to let the directors know. What do the directors do? Well, I suggest they tell the shareholders, which shouldn't, you know, they'd look in a mirror and say, hey, did you know we didn't do an audit? Well, should have told me. Do you need to change the accounts? Personally, I wouldn't unless you think you're going to get a complaint. So if you think, say, the bank were expecting audited accounts, I mean, we know there's no bankers here. Most bankers don't know the difference between an audit, you know, and a sandwich. So they probably wouldn't notice. But if you think you've got a minority shareholder who might complain, prospective purchaser, you might need to say, look, do we need to go and get these audited and replace the accounts at Companies House? But as a rule, I wouldn't. I wouldn't panic. Tell the client, if the client says, hey, we didn't want an audit anyway, you know, let's just sort it out for next year, then you shouldn't have a big problem. Quick plug for one of our manuals. Have you got procedures for dealing with audit exemption? I'm sure there's other sources of reference, but we have procedures manuals where you have something like that. So on your larger clients, on your larger companies, you put in a risk assessment form so that you can identify whether there is an audit likely to be the case. There's a couple of frequently asked questions in the notes that we're not going to dwell on massively, but you know, the rules can be quite complex. So there's an example. We've got small company. It's hovering around the top of the small company thresholds when you look at employees. Is it done on full-time equivalents? No. Is the answer. It's not based on full-time equivalents. It's It's a fairly stupid way of calculating it. So if you're thinking of something like a charity, where I believe you do work out full-time equivalents for working out disclosure, and certainly for medium companies, it's full-time equivalents. It's not for working out size. It's the number of employment contracts in existence each month, irrespective of the number of hours worked. And then you say, well, what's the number for that month? Work out the number for each month and do it on average like that. So the implication is, if your client has a lot of staff turnover, they can have a lot more than you think. And I've left a couple of clients thinking, hey, great, here's a non-audit small company. You think, well, are you sure that you haven't got a bigger problem because you've got an awful lot of staff turnover? Groups, I think I've talked about groups, so I will move on from the group. But with groups, it's all about groups. I can't say it enough times. You've got to look at the group. Be very careful taking on a subsidiary, and they say you can just do small audit-exempt accounts. I don't know if this is interesting at all. A Companies House, I hope there's no one from Companies House here. You wonder who works at Companies House. You've clearly all dealt with Companies House, haven't you? So, is it a bunch of trained monkeys or badly trained monkeys? I'm not sure, because what they reject seems incredibly erratic if my clients are anything to go by. You know, I've had things sent back because, you know, the page numbers were wrong, which, okay, is a mistake, but it hardly seems to warrant a rejection. And other times I've had, you know, my firm's taken on new clients and the filed balance sheet doesn't balance. And you think, what set of procedures are they operating at Companies House where they pick up the tiniest thing and yet the obvious thing that seems to go missing? So the message, I think, of this slide, and there's a little bit more in the notes, but the message is, if you can get the simple things right, then you are going to make life easier for yourself. Now, whether that's a disclosure checklist, a completion checklist on the accounts, or just a kick up the backside of whoever does this stuff for you, but, you know, can you just make sure, have you got reference material that you've got, you know, the correct statements on the account? So that'd be the correct statements on the director's report about reference to the Companies Act prepared in accordance with the right section of the Companies Act 2006. Have you got, you know, a Companies Act handbook from someone or a disclosure checklist? So you've got the correct audit exemption statement on the balance sheet. The next one is, you know, as Steve Wright would say, it's just muppetry. So someone has tried to file another set of accounts. I guess that's people who use Word. Are there really 17,000 sets of accounts produced in Word or Excel still? Perhaps there are. So they've copied it forward and just forgotten to change the year end. And so Companies House rightly say, well, that doesn't make any sense. We've already got the 2008 accounts. Name of the signatory is missing. So again, you know, there are an awful lot of accounts sent back for that. Audit exemption statement missing. Again, that wording wrong. Accounting reference date just missing. Or incorrect. So someone's done a typo and they've made it up to the 31st of February or something. You know, just basic things. But if you're anything like most practices, a lot of accounts go in pretty close to the wire, don't they? Or maybe it's just my clients. And, you know, if you've told the client that, hey, we promise we're going to get it in for you. If you bring your records in, please come in and sign the accounts. Please, we'll do it. And then they bounce back 2 days late going, oh, no, just because we got something wrong. So I do try and make sure that these simple things, must admit I haven't added it up, but that would be an awful lot of accounts that got accepted first time if someone had just done a few basic bits of checking before filing them. Abbreviated accounts. So a show of hands then, who regularly files abbreviated accounts? Most of you, that's interesting. When I ask, you know, more generally, I get mixed responses, I suppose. It's about two-thirds on average. Sometimes I ask a room and it's 50%. So this is our standard answer to why would you file abbreviated accounts? The general public don't see as much information. That's true. I might put in brackets, do the general public ever look for the accounts? But in principle, it's there. I think the next point is interesting. It's less to get wrong. Well, perhaps, but the disadvantage is it's two sets of accounts. So I sometimes say to my clients, right, you're doing abbreviated accounts. Do you think anyone cares? And is the client paying for it? Maybe it takes you no time at all. I haven't been in practice for 12 years, if you followed the dates on my introduction. But when we were in practice and we had Audit 2000 that then got bought by Sage, It would take, you know, I suppose about half an hour each time to produce each draft of the abbreviated accounts, because you had to change a couple of settings and watch these wind-up PCs as they slowly chug through the notes trying to do it. And we often thought to ourselves, wow, you know, the client doesn't really care. It's one more thing to sign. And actually, do we charge? Somehow that abbreviated set of accounts gets lost in the costings. And I wonder whether, it wouldn't be a lot, but whether for some of us, actually, if we could say, look, if you want abbreviated accounts, you know, that'll be another 100 quid, that'll be another 500 quid. And some of my clients are doing that. They're saying, look, if you want abbreviated, it's actually extra work, you're going to pay for it. Abbreviated accounts, I suppose, do have some benefits, and that they do reduce the information available to the general public. We'll look at some of the exemptions in a second. I suppose one aside, what you could think about is, of course, don't forget the Companies Act allows proper abbreviated accounts. It also allows certain things not to be filed. So one of the common responses when you say, why do you have abbreviated accounts, is gross profit. I don't want the general public to see the markup that my client makes. Okay, just don't file the P&L. And that's fine. You don't have to file a P&L with small company accounts, and I've got some clients that do that. They just take the P&L off. The downside, of course, is that there you still show the related party information. So what else is exempt in proper abbreviated accounts? Yes, the P&L account goes. There's no director's report, but then that's not really very insightful anymore. There's no disclosure of director's interests anyway in a director's report. So I'm not sure you save much by saying what the principal activity is. It's an abbreviated balance sheet, but really it doesn't make a lot of difference, and you just have a different statement at the bottom. You do have to include the accounting policies, of course. On the abbreviated accounts, there's not a lot in there, I suppose, of any excitement anyway. Share capital would go in. You'll get totals of the fixed assets in the various overall categories, totals for debtors due after 1 year, but of course no breakdown, if that means anything, might do to some clients. You get the total amount of secured creditors, but there's no breakdown. Creditors due after 1 year and creditors due after 5 years. But those last four bullet points are always included. So it depends. Sometimes I think people do abbreviated accounts, and actually the one thing they wanted to hide was all the transactions going through the director's loan account. It's in there anyway. So we'll come back perhaps later if we've got time to look at the related party rules, because a lot of people are getting confused. But if your client has an overdrawn loan account, then the Companies Act requires you to disclose that. I think I've got the section number somewhere, but you must disclose the fact the client's had an advance, as the Companies Act call it, an overdrawn director's loan account at any point in the year, and the repayments. And there are S's on there deliberately. It's not total advances and total repayments. It is advances and repayments. So if your client has a loan account like a ping pong ball, take some money out, put some money in, take some money out, put some money in. It goes in credit, it goes in debit, it goes in credit, it goes in debit. You should know the Companies Act says you've got to disclose all those separately. Now, you may want to take some kind of rational approach and aggregate that by class of transaction, but do your working papers files identify whether your director's loan accounts go overdrawn? And a lot of people's don't. You look at the file and you see here's total payments, total receipts, the dividend we fudged at the end of the year. I'll come back to that. Yes, clearly that's something I need to talk about. And it comes down to a total at the end. So was it ever overdrawn? And your files probably couldn't support that. And then some people say, but all I've got to do, David, is work out the maximum overdrawn amount. No, that's the 85 Act. That's been gone for several years now. It's not the maximum overdrawn amount. That's not the disclosure. It's any advance, any time the director takes money that pushes them overdrawn, that's an advance, you should disclose that. Any time they put money back in, you should disclose that. That's what the Act says, but perhaps you can take some kind of rational summarisation or aggregation of those ins and outs, but you must be aware of what the Act says. Or someone could say, you know, these are wrong. And you might say, yeah, but no one's rejected my accounts yet. The problem is, the danger is, if you miss something like that, your client falls out or someone looks at the accounts, they could say, hold on, you've missed that. Does that mean they weren't properly filed? So those accounts from 2 years ago, I'm going to complain to Companies House about those. Companies House notice, for once, there's a problem. They say, no, you're right, there's a big gap in the accounts. They weren't properly filed, so they're now 2 years late. So you just need to be a little bit careful. I don't think you can ignore this. Okay, so I think we talked about that. A little bit on the future. I'm always loath to talk too much about the future because you're all thinking, I've got enough problems tomorrow. Well, tomorrow's Sunday, I suppose. Trying to work off what I've eaten today. I've got enough problems Monday worrying about what to do in the office without trying to worry about what may or may not happen in the future. So I'm not going to talk about it for too much, but I think it's worth just giving you a heads up because there's a real danger when I talk to all accountants that anything international is pointless, irrelevant, and only applies to listed companies. I don't need to listen. I've already switched off. Who's that standing at the front? You know, there's a real danger that anything international kind of goes off our radar, particularly if you're not auditing, as we've already had all the international auditing standards. But the international standards changing slash replacing the UK standards has been all but agreed. So it is coming. It is going to be December 2015 year ends. And so I appreciate many of you might not do accounts for medium, large and quoted companies. But for anyone doing medium, large and quoted companies, that is the new framework. You're not really supposed to call it tiers anymore. But if you've got a parent of a listed group, you'll do full IFRSs, as you do now already probably. FRS 101 is a new FRS. That will be for subsidiaries or parents of a quoted group. That's kind of full IFRSs with some exemptions and reductions. And then this is UK GAAP from 2015, catchily called FRS 102. So that's now everything. So if you ever have to look something up from 2015 onwards, if you're looking at the Frizzy or whatever potentially replaces it in the future, it will be all be referring not to SAP 19, not to FRS 10. It will be referring to FRS 102. FRS 102 is 250 pages, but it's not as bad as it sounds because that's everything. That becomes UK GAAP. There's not much difference in there. We're not particularly going to worry about that. I suppose many of you won't deal with those companies anyway. There was a lot of debate as to why it was going to change a lot. That was then retracted, and that draft, FRS 102 now, the only real difference for those companies we think is going to be deferred tax plus, which means that you keep doing deferred tax as you do now, except for revaluation, unrealized revaluation gains do cause a deferred tax provision to be included. So if you revalue a property, so investment property or freehold property, that's debit the asset, credit revaluation reserve on the balance sheet. At the moment, under the FRS and under the Frizzy, you would disclose the gain that would be payable if it was sold. So you should be doing that now already. That's just disclosure with a revalued asset. But what FRS 102 is going to say is, hey, if you ever revalue an asset, you need to put through a tax provision through the P&L for that. And I suppose the question, as we say at the bottom, is what's going to happen with the Frizzy? And this is the massive question, because I think tiers 1 to 3 is pretty much ready to be rubber stamped to the end of next month, I think. The big debate now has moved to the Frizzy. Are they going to update the Frizzy and when? If they are going to update the Frizzy, it might say, well, okay, we'll do deferred tax plus. And that's worth keeping an eye on, because you might have clients who, for bank or for a lot of reasons, say, hey, we want to revalue our assets as often as possible. You say, well, you can do that. You can have a very healthy, I suppose, top half of the balance sheet, but bang, you're going to have a big tax charge. So you need to be aware of that. What else might happen to the Frizzy? Well, we just don't know. Some people will say, let's get rid of it, because there may be something coming underneath, which is on the next slide. So why have the Frizzy as well? Why have 5 disclosure options? It's all very up in the air. You do please need to keep reading the press, because the Frizzy could change before 2015. So there's a lot of people debating, saying, well, the Frizzy is still very widely used. Why don't we change it next year? Why don't we start to play with it over the next few years to try and get it ready for harmonisation rather than waiting? So the Frizzy could change ahead of the other standards to be ready for them. Frizzy could be dropped, although fingers crossed, I'm not sure that's likely. What the Frizzy could do is it could be subject to EU maximum harmonisation, which sounds like a boy band. Maximum harmonisation means that, and this is already adopted in Europe, it's just when it applies to the UK, that says that the maximum disclosure you can have in your accounts is the following 5 notes. Now, I don't have them off the top of my head, but there are 5 notes required by maximum harmonisation. And because it's maximum harmonisation, you can't add to it. So you could, you know, who knows what's going to happen to the frizzy? It could disappear, could change next week. It could change and actually be much shorter because it takes out all but these five notes. So I'm not sure it's worth talking to your clients, but maybe you just want to warn them a little bit. Look, we are going to see some change in your accounts, and potentially the frizzy goes altogether. But I think my main message is if you see an article in one of your members' magazines or something on a course that says the future of UK GAAP, the changes to accounting standards, please don't go to sleep, because Tier 4 is going to affect something like 60, 70% of the companies on Companies House. Then we have the micro entity debate slash debacle. Where are we now? I've got to say, I don't know if you've heard anything about the revenues position about micro entities. This is nothing to do with what the revenue are talking about for micro entities, because it's not entities. So the revenue debate, as I heard from my colleague yesterday, micro businesses, the proposal in the April 12 budget was it's going to be entities below the VAT threshold. They can do cash accounting. They can stay in that until they're turning over 100,000. So that's the proposal in the budget, possibly from April next year. That's not companies, because companies have GAAP. You know, companies are subject to UK GAAP, to the frizzy, to the Companies Act at the moment. You can't just wipe away all of that need for a true and fair set of accounts. So it would have to take some pretty serious changes in law and in accounting, but there's a lot of political input. The EU have already approved that, yes, we want everyone to adopt it. Now each member state needs to go ahead and set their own rules. So it's a case of, does the UK want it? Do you think an embattled coalition would like to announce they've saved small businesses the average of £1,000 each with new micro-entity regime? I think it's very politically attractive. And so it seems very likely we will get something. Now, whether it's worth the paper we're written on, pardon my cynicism, it remains to be seen. Proposal number one, if you're interested, because it's quite humorous, I think it was the DTI, or what used to be DTI, is it Biz now or something, or De Boer, reminds me of Chris De Burgh. They appointed someone anyway to do it. They appointed a top London lawyer. I think good choice for doing small business reporting needs. And this is not a joke. Apparently his qualification was his brother ran a small business. So good choice. His proposal was, I know what would simplify it. Let's have a cash basis for the accounts and a statement of assets. So we can't call it a balance sheet because, of course, it won't balance. You know, it won't balance to anything. It won't agree to anything. So you'll have a cash set of accounts, and then you'll have a statement of assets. So, I mean, you can imagine all the professional bodies, I'm sure yours was the same, were just up in arms. Not just because we're going to lose money, but how do you run a business? You're telling people you have to keep some kind of records because you need a statement of assets. So what are your debtors, creditors, stock, balance sheet, maybe a total for fixed assets. So you've got to keep some kind of records. But don't worry about using those records for the profit and loss account because it's just on cash. It just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem to save time. And what kind of quality information are you going to get? You know, how does your growing business, bearing in mind the limits, although they change every day, you know, something turning over 440,000, they're going to have employees, aren't they? How do they manage that business? How do they go to the bank saying, well, look, here's my cash ins and cash outs, and I've made up some assets and liabilities that may or may not agree to anything? So lots of people complained and say, you're not meeting any objective. You're not saving time, you're not saving costs, and you're not providing good information to businesses. And actually, as accountants, we could see one of the problems was this was optional. So I come into you, I run a business turning over 400,000, and I say, right, my objective is to pay as little corporation tax, honestly. You know, I want to honestly just pay, according to the rules, as small corporation tax as possible. What do you do then? Use the cash basis or not? You do both, don't you? Because you don't want to get sued for negligence. You have to do both to decide which is best. So how has that saved any time and costs for the business? So anyway, enough nagging about that. Lots of people complained. Quietly, that report was withdrawn and hidden away. Proposal number two, which is seeming to gain a bit more acceptance, is this idea of a simplified accruals basis. Again, we need to see a bit more detail to see whether they're going to flesh it out. The idea seems to be you do accruals for everything but overheads. So you, I know, so you would probably have stock. So you'd have age debtors, you know, you'd have debtors, trade creditors, but you wouldn't bother doing accruals and prepayments for electric, you know, gas, rent, rates. And you think, that's going to save hours, isn't it? I mean, really? You just think, who writes this stuff? So you wonder quite what that's going to achieve. I suppose the key bit, perhaps, is the bit where it says limited disclosure. So while the actual double entry may not be much more detailed, you know, it may be essentially the same, what it might mean is that you don't then have to split out related parties, you know, you don't have to have lots of accounting policies, break down the fixed assets. So you may save a little bit of time in the disclosure. This may link to the EU maximum harmonisation, and they're saying, well, okay, your accounts will be simplified accruals with five notes, very simple. It's not going to save a lot of time and effort for your average punter, is it? So I'm not sure where they're coming from, but that's what's out there at the moment. And I suppose with that is, will we get a rolling out of the HMRC's or the government proposals for non-companies into these proposals so that you have this simplified accruals basis of accounts? The taxation will then become this proposed simplified basis, which is a set number of deductions. You know, you have set deductions rather than doing actual deductions, so maybe the tax becomes simple as well. Don't know. As you can see in the bottom proposal, the limits have gone up slightly, so we'll see what happens. But, you know, they are some decent-sized entities turning over 590,000. But I actually wonder, in practice, by the time you take account of companies that grow and shrink, transitional rules, whether a lot of us will say, well, stuff that. What, you know, it'd be more expensive for the client if we adopt this when the client next door has a slightly different set of accounts. You know, we've got to train all our staff, got to buy computer systems to run both set of accounts. Why don't we just keep doing what we're doing? So I wonder whether that will actually save any costs, but it's rumbling around. There is quite a lot of attention being paid to it in some parts. Okay, so that's enough about the future. Shall we look at a few issues that might affect us now? So some common problem areas. So that's what I'd be saying if I was talking to a group of auditors. Post-balance sheet events, and primarily as accountants, you'll be looking at the period from the year end to the point at which the directors approve the accounts. There are two kinds of post-balance sheet event, as we know, adjusting and non-adjusting post-balance sheet event. And if we were to look at some examples, you can see them there. Post-year-end settlement of an ongoing court case would be adjusting because the court case was in place at the year-end. Diminution in the value of a property if the post-year-end diminution or the post-year-end sale evidenced the position at the balance sheet date. Bankruptcy, you would usually adjust for, put it on the breakout basis. And discovery of fraud and error relating to the year, that would be an adjusting post-balance sheet event. Non-adjusting events, so events that would be significant enough, the users of the accounts should see them, but you wouldn't actually adjust for in terms of changing the numbers. Merger, acquisition, issue of new shares, fire or flood, that would need to be fairly significant or catastrophic. Opening up of a new trading activity, they would all be non-adjusting post-balance sheet events. So, for example then, it would seem to be quite a straightforward example. Secretary of State says that pregnant women, OAPs and children should not eat soft cheese after reports of listeria. This results in a drop in sales. 150,000 of stock is thrown away as a result, 50,000 of which was year-end stock. So, do we need to adjust for that? We've got an example in the notes. Certainly, we do need to adjust for that. We need to adjust for the 50,000 that was in stock because the net realisable value of that stock has become nil. Example number two, which is no reference to a certain very large managing director who died in mysterious circumstances, didn't they, on their boat several years ago. The managing director was found dead in mysterious circumstances, has sold the company investments 3 years ago and hidden this by keeping copies. So this is always my cautionary tale to juniors, whether they're auditing or preparing accounts. If you have a client who consistently says, I can't find the originals, would the photocopies be okay? At some point, you may need to ask, well, no. It's surprising how many people we see trying to send their accountant email copies of bank statements. And it just starts to make me a little bit nervous that sometimes, you know, that bank statement just could be anything, could be totally made up. Do we need to keep asking for the originals, some independent information? I appreciate it might not be an audit, but often the lack of records in the average small business makes me wonder whether the bank statement is the one thing that we can rely on. That's what, when we used to have brown paper bag jobs, as we called them, from farmers in our office, they'd come in, well, they weren't meant to be brown, but you get the idea, in they would come. And you think, if I can make the bank balance, that's the only thing I can trust. And we just need to be careful. We're not relying too much on copies sometimes, I think. But here we have this example. So 3 years ago, this was removed. This was stolen. Do we adjust for it? Yes, of course we do. Don't forget, though, this is an example of a post-balance sheet event. It's a fundamental error. We would adjust it in the opening balances. Okay, so this would be a prior year adjustment because it happened several years ago. It's a fundamental error, so we need to change the opening balances if it's material. We don't write it off in this year. We write it off in the opening balances. We do a prior year adjustment. So restate the opening balances, restate the comparatives, and then you need a statement of total recognised gains and losses to show the reserves as previously stated and the adjustment. Another aside, I'm terrible at these. I mentioned materiality in that statement. I wonder how many of you calculate materiality on your non-audit jobs. Now, I'm really passionate that people should. I know a lot of people think, nonsense, materiality is an auditing term. I think, no, it's not. All accounting standards, they only apply to material items. So if you're looking at anything under the frizzy and you're saying, do we need to disclose it or not, your question should be, is it material? Now, how do you assess that? Well, if you were audit firms, I'd say just go and grab the materiality form out of your audit manual and use that. But, you know, you could make an assessment. 3% of turnover, 5% of turnover. But I think it can be incredibly useful to have that on your non-audit files. You know, because it would save some of you a lot of work. It may be much better than my clients, but the amount of times I see deferred tax of 25 quid, and I think, oh, you know, it costs the client more than that in you posting the journal and writing a lead schedule each year. You know, accruals being adjusted for £5 and £2. And I think, come on, some sense of materiality would be really helpful. And if you find you're taking too long on jobs or your staff are, you know, we say to guys, well, do a materiality schedule. Tell people what level below which we are not going to adjust or we're not going to analyse. And I know we don't trust most of our clients, but there must be a level below which we say, actually, you know, if sundries are only 100 quid, I don't need a schedule of that. You know, especially if it's already in Sage. Do any of your guys do that? The amount of people I see is printed in Sage and they write it out again by hand to prove that they've analysed it. And you think, oh, must be quiet in that office. But some concept of materiality, what needs to be investigated, what needs to be vouched, and under the frizzy, what needs to be disclosed and adjusted. That can really help limit the amount of work if you're struggling to hit your budget. Budgets on jobs, that's a whole other discussion. Let's move on before we get into muddy waters. Bonuses, difficult area. But don't forget, we've talked about post-balance sheet events. And you could also look at the frizzy and the accounting standards on provisions. And bonuses should only be provided for if there is an obligation at the year end. And we know historically they're decided post year end. You've got to be really careful that you are only adjusting for a bonus because there was an obligation at the year end, but perhaps post year end you had to decide the amount. You know, that's okay. So there was a contractual or a constructive obligation at the year end, but you didn't know the amount, you were waiting for the profits. Okay, you can decide on the amount post year end and post it back. Other than that, I don't think you can put it in there. You know, you can't look at the accounts post year end and have the director say, what do you think? Should we put a bonus in? You know, there's no bonus in my contract of employment. I don't get a bonus. I'm on a fixed salary. And so if we get a Christmas bonus, it would be a miracle, but it has to go in the subsequent year, which annoys our finance director intently, which is why we get cheap champagne when one of the directors goes on holiday. You know, Israeli champagne is top notch. But it doesn't go in the December accounts because it was decided on once they'd had a look at the December management accounts. It can't go back unless there is an obligation. Maybe a history of bonuses creates an expectation in your staff or in your client's staff. You could say, is that a constructive obligation? They'd get stroppy, they'd leave, so there is a constructive obligation. But be careful. We have known the revenue challenge some of these and say, no, you've got to take it out. You can't deduct for this bonus. Where's the obligation at the 31st of December for this bonus? If there isn't one, it needs to come out. So there needs to be an obligation out of past performance. Maybe it's published policy. So there might not be a contract. There could be a memo that goes around saying, hope you're going to enjoy your bonus. But is there something that confirms there is an obligation or a valid expectation? And how do you document it? So we've given a scenario or two in the notes. There's one, I guess it's fairly self-explanatory. Someone with a history of bonuses. One is a new company, never paid bonuses. Which are you going to allow? If you're a revenue inspector being difficult, which are you more likely to be relaxed about? So certainly with your new clients with no history of bonuses, you need to talk to them pre-year end. I guess actually director's bonuses are reasonably rare anyway because most people take dividends. But in principle, director's bonuses are really difficult, I think. Even more difficult than staff because a director could change their mind. You know, one of the directors could waive it and say, no, actually, I've slept on it, I've changed my mind. So actually, you know, even though I voted for it pre-year end, is that really an obligation until it's paid? Because a director might say, well, I know I said in December I wanted it, but the January figures are a bit iffy, let's change our minds. So director's bonuses are really problematic unless you have something in the director's employment contract. An employment contract, that's interesting. Dividends. Right, judging on the earlier laugh, I want to be careful. Don't shoot me, I just tell you the rules, I don't write them. You should not provide for a dividend unless it was approved, unless it was agreed pre-year end. Okay, now that's law, that's company law. To do otherwise is fraudulent. I think one of the pictures was taken out of my slides because it didn't quite fit your logos, but a picture of a guy in handcuffs. But it is fraud. In theory, because you're all covered by the money laundering rules, if you ever did backdate a dividend into the previous period, you then have to report yourself to SOCA for committing a fraud. And so you do need to be really careful, because potentially, if anyone else sees your file, so when you, if you ever lose the client and it goes to another firm of accountants and they see a letter, you know, heaven forbid, you sent a letter to the client saying, just reviewed the December annual accounts, and why don't we put 50 grand dividend back into the December account? You know, if you've written that to the client, I'll visit you in prison and bring you some chocolates and a nail file, whatever it takes. But do be really careful. And I know that it's endemic in the profession. But I also know, I've been told, there are two partners of accountancy firms doing community service because they've been caught. So you see what happens, the revenue, it must have been big numbers, I appreciate. A couple of thousand here and there probably would go unnoticed. Revenue starts to investigate the client and says, what's this dividend? Where's the dividend documentation? Where's your minute of a board meeting that says, before the year end, we agree, because the shareholders must approve a final dividend. So as directors and shareholders, pre-year end, we've agreed the dividend will be this much. So the revenue asks the client, says, the accountant told me to do it, and he's got PI. Go and speak to him. So they go to the accountant. Where is it? We've subpoenaed your files, and the files say, you know, the best way to reduce tax or to eliminate tax is to put this dividend back into the previous period. And they say, thank you very much. Would you like prison or community service? And they took community service. And so you do need to be careful. You must, if you have a dividend strategy, talk to your clients pre-year end, or you are potentially committing a criminal offence. And sometimes people do it when they don't need to. It's become such a habit. So sometimes I go with my colleague Sharon and we look at accounts and we look at the tax treatment of companies, and she tells me, you'd be surprised how many people do it, and they increase the pre-year end, they increase the tax in the previous period because they're so in the habit of saying, right, now we've done the accounts, what dividend do we need to clear the loan account, or what dividend do we need that matches last year's? And they're just so in the habit of clearing the loan account or of putting dividends back into the previous year, no one actually looks whether it's better for tax. tax. And so sometimes, I don't know, what's the opposite of money laundering? You're actually costing the client money by breaking the law. I suppose that's just silly, really. But do please be careful, because I think that we are going to see more accountants attacked for it. Because most firms would be easy meat. I reckon if an inspector sat in many firms around the country and said, you know, give me 10 companies, half of them would probably have some dodgy dividend documentation. You know, dare I say, stop the recording. You know, if you're going to do it, don't write it down. Or if the client tells you to do something, then make sure it's clear the client told you to do it, so it's not your advice. Or if the client told you to do it, if the client is confident they made a decision but didn't tell you, then get them to sign that. You know, do you do letters of representation or dividend vouchers for clients? Get them to sign something that says, you know, I confirm as a director, just before Christmas, I wanted a dividend of 20,000, or I agreed that I should clear the loan account, I just forgot to tell the accountant. And that might be legitimate and honest. And so then your note would say, okay, I know now we're in the middle of May, but I have something from the client that says in December he wanted a dividend, so all I'm doing is writing up minutes, all I'm doing is actioning a pre-year-end discussion.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. If you have a client come to you and he says, oh, last December we sat around the kitchen table, we had a board meeting, we voted a dividend of 50,000, but we didn't produce the paperwork, what's the view on them producing that paperwork retrospectively?
Yeah, I think that's the same argument. If I would even date it today. I wouldn't sort of lie, because we had the firm told off, shall we say, quite badly because they just backdated it. So they had a dividend note that said whatever it was, you know, 24th of December, the client and we agreed to do this. And I don't know quite how it went wrong. I think it might have been because they then printed it, and on Word it automatically did the printing date at the bottom. So, you know, I think this was an institute. So it's the inspector's going, well, clearly you've lied. And that makes me very worried about the behaviour of this firm. Whereas if it had said, you know, whatever it is today, 20th of May, the client has confirmed categorically he decided with the other shareholders to do a dividend on the 24th of December and we're only just now writing up. Fine, I can't argue with that. I can't call you a liar because it's all clearly documented on file. So I think that's, you know, if you can, you document it like that. Even better is, you know the year ends of your clients. You email them, you know, 30 days before their year end, or write to them and say, here's a blank dividend voucher. Can you fill in the right number and send it back to me? At least it's in there. The ball is with them, really. Whereas I think too many firms just stay quiet about it, and then potentially months after the year end, when they're desperately near the filing deadline, they try and then do retrospective tax planning, and it doesn't work for dividends. It's against the law. Okay, that's enough. That's cheered you up enormously. I suppose I should say that in theory, if shareholders should have full 14-day notice of meeting, or there should be consent to short notice. So if you want to do it really properly, then even in your situation, the directors had a meeting. If they didn't give proper notice, you should also get them to say, and everyone present waives the notice, and so on. How do you disclose dividends? So moving on, I suppose, back to some disclosure issues. For the avoidance of doubt, directors are related parties. A dividend is a transaction. Hopefully that's not upsetting you too much. So a dividend to a director is a related party transaction. Okay, I don't think there's any doubt, although a lot of people try to argue otherwise. Also, a director's close family is a related party, whatever that might mean. It's a bit more vague in the frizzy, but often it would be members of the same household. So director's spouse or domestic partner, as the standards say. That would be a related party. Significant shareholder, someone owning more than 20%, they'd be a related party. So you disclose dividends to them. Okay, there's no debate. None of us used to do it. Why? Because directors' interest was shown in the director's report. So we all thought, well, if anyone's that bothered and they've got a calculator, they might be able to take total dividends multiplied by the director's shareholdings, and they might be able to work it out. It's often more complicated because I know some of you have done these, A, B and C shares. Directors might waive the dividend for tax reasons. But I think that was our argument pre-April 2007. Of course, now we don't have directors' interests in the accounts. And so there's no way to prove the dividends to directors. And what about other related parties? So what about close family? What about other significant shareholders? So we need to disclose dividends to directors. You can use some form of aggregation. So if you've given some thought to materiality, you don't have to disclose each dividend separately. You can aggregate it by class of transaction and category of related party, if you like. So you still have to list them. So you perhaps say, you know, John, Fred and Bert, directors of the company, they had dividends totaling 50,000. So you've disclosed who's in the category of related party, and you've disclosed the total dividend. So that can be an element of aggregation while still giving the totals. Yeah?
Yeah, it's about payment of ex-dividend, interim dividend, sorry. Full-year accounts, does it need only disclose full final dividend?
No, all dividends paid. Yeah, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And then another class of related party might be close family of directors. So you might say that these people also had a dividend and what the total was. But you need to name who's in that class of related party and you need to give a total. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, related party transactions are not in the abbreviated accounts. And it is perhaps for some people the biggest reason for doing abbreviated accounts is that you can take out related party transactions. Not loans to directors, because that's a Companies Act requirement, but accounting standards disclosure is not needed in the abbreviated accounts because of small companies, because they don't give a true and fair view, so the accounting standards don't apply. Okay, let's keep going then. Couple of things on fixed assets. Tangible fixed assets. The Companies Act says you have to depreciate them, so please depreciate them. If not, the only way to justify non-depreciation is because of a long useful life or a high residual value or a combination of both. You know, I don't care what the current market value is. I don't care how that they repair it quite a lot. It's irrelevant. They're old requirements. And if you want to justify it, you need to think to yourself, what's the residual value? You know, it makes me a bit cross, because these things matter to me, I suppose, that people talk about market value. You know, current market value is this, so we don't need to depreciate. Oh, that's just nonsense. You know, you all know how to calculate depreciation. Cost less residual value, not cost less market value. So your argument in the accounts, your disclosure needs to be that residual value is so high that depreciation would be material, or the number underneath, economic life is so big as to make depreciation immaterial. That's what the standards say justifies non-depreciation, the fact that depreciation is immaterial, not that you keep it in a good state of repair and the market value is high and so on and so on. Of course, that's different for, let's move on to investment properties, shall we? So I doubt many of you will revalue normal properties. Investment properties, you don't depreciate investment properties because they don't wear out in that sense. That's what depreciation is trying to track. They don't wear out. They're not used in the business. They are an investment. It has to be finished, so construction and development should be complete. You can't use it by the company, so it's more if you have an investment property and then use one of the floors as your head office, that probably excludes it from being an investment property. If you let it to other group companies, no matter the rate, that excludes it from being an investment property. The treatment then, the treatment is really easy. I see so much nonsense written in sets of accounts as people getting confused between revaluation of freehold property and revaluation of investment property. Investment properties are easy, no depreciation, show it at market value. Okay, that's it. Don't start telling me about whether it was revalued 3 years ago and you'll revalue it every 5 years. You know, don't start worrying about an impairment review. What? You're all getting mixed up with other rules. It's market value. Every year, what is the market value? That can be done internally. So what is the market value? Put it at the market value. So debit or credit the asset, debit or credit the revaluation reserve. And that's it. Simple. Surprising how many sets of accounts I have where the market value of investment properties has remained the same for the last 10 years. And I usually raise an eyebrow at that point in the guise of Mr. Spock and say, that's interesting. You know, in the current climate, you haven't changed the market value of that investment property for 10 years. I'd like to see the director's calculations and comparison of gains on the capital markets to justify why they think that return or the comparison to other properties justifies that? And I would suggest you do ask some of those difficult questions, because it might be, as the market has dipped in some towns, directors are quite happily waving sets of accounts with your name on at banks, saying, look how good the balance sheet is, where in reality they should be shaving some pretty big numbers off of some of these investment properties. It's quite possible to have a negative revaluation reserve. So if you think it's just market movements, even if the value of the investment property goes below cost, you can still keep revaluing it through the revaluation reserve. That's fine. You can keep doing that. But if you think there is an impairment, so it'll never go back to cost, then you would take it through the P&L. And that can be a painful discussion. And a discussion I don't see happening very often on a lot of files. So you'll see people revaluing the investment property down. There you go, David, we did what you said last time you visited. And you look down and the revaluation reserve is a debit. And you think, okay, that is allowable. But have you had the discussion as to why that is only a temporary diminution and not an impairment? And no, they haven't. Because, of course, that could be a big issue. And I've got some clients, even in South Wales, where they have firms, they have companies that have bought some properties, you know, speculatively, really at the height of the market, and they're never going to get up to where they were. They're never going to get up to that, partly because the M4 is never going to go there. Perhaps they were told by their mate on the council, yes, honestly, it would. So some of those need to be impaired. Some of those accounts need to take a pretty big hit. So you need to think about that. You should disclose who valued it. Usually it would be an employee, and that's absolutely fine for it to be the directors. But of course, if it was someone else, then by all means disclose that. That would be fantastic. Fantastic for the bank manager to know that the investment property was actually valued by someone other than the directors. Okay, we've got about 7 minutes left before I get ushered off. How about recognition of income? It's a question we do get quite a lot sometimes. Because we have a technical query line, people do ring. One of the questions, we had a spate of them. And I suppose we just want to illustrate a principle with this, that maybe as a firm or with individual clients, you need to think about. Selling property, at what point do you recognise income? So maybe we could do it by show of hands, but you might have to close your eyes in case you're worried someone else will see. Who would recognise the sale of a property on exchange? Who would recognise it on completion? Right, now I'm an auditor. Who hasn't put their hand up? See, that's a test of completeness. Well done. So, generally, I think you would do it on exchange if it's unconditional, and completion is often too late. If the exchange is unconditional, we would say you do it on exchange. You've got a contract, they're committed to it. If there's no other conditions, then you look at the accounting standard and say, well, you've got a right to consideration under the accounting standards. If the exchange is unconditional, what's stopping you recognising that income? I think at least you need to think about it. I've been to some firms and it varies per property depending on where they want the profits to be. I'm not sure that's sustainable in the middle of an investigation. And sometimes you go to firms where it's different per partner or per manager. Whoever's prepared the accounts does it on a whim. And I think perhaps some thought is required and some notes because, say, these are big numbers. Aren't they? You get this in the wrong period, your client's going to have a bit of a shock when the tax bill changes significantly. So our advice generally would be if the exchange is unconditional, you do it on exchange. Otherwise, you do it on completion. We've got an example here in the notes that, I won't go through it in too much detail because It's difficult sometimes with these kind of situations to know exactly what to do. There's lots of stuff in the notes about how you would do it, but we would look at, is it an unconditional exchange? So if the property's not built, I think that's a pretty big condition, and you wouldn't recognise it on exchange in those cases. So if you've got a client selling off plan, selling with an incomplete building, you're not going to recognise it then, are you? But if you've got a finished building, where, you know, the survey's been done, everyone's happy, they've exchanged, why wouldn't you recognise it then? What could possibly stop the sale? And if the sale was stopped, surely the vendor could sue for it because he's met all the conditions of sale. So perhaps some thought, some supporting work, and in some firms, some consistency to make sure that everyone's happy, they're singing from the same hymn sheet if they get an investigation. So finally, in 5 minutes then, we'll look at some more examples of related party transactions because it is the biggest talking point, perhaps more so under FRS 8. And so I'm assuming that most of you, you've got small companies, you use the Frizzy, but there may be some of you that don't. We do have some firms that have a lot of small companies and never use the Frizzy. I've never quite understood why, because the Frizzy, say it's more, it has, you know, exemptions, it has simplified reporting requirements, and usually it's a good thing to use the Frizzy. So I'll try and mention briefly the differences between FRS 8 and the Frizzy. What does the Companies Act say about directors' transactions? Well, I think we've already talked a little bit about overdrawn loan accounts, and so perhaps won't dwell on that anymore. Of course, the Companies Act also requires disclosure of directors' remuneration in the full accounts, which we need to do. There's the reference, in case you don't believe me, for disclosing overdrawn directors' loan accounts, and you should disclose the amount or amounts. If there's lots of them, the interest rate, the main conditions, and any amount repaid. But I think in reality, most professionals are saying, well, okay, can we take some reasonable approach to aggregate these kind of transactions? So I would say yes. I mean, you have to bear in mind that's your decision. That's not what the law says. The law says, you know, if the client's got a zero loan account and goes and buys a Mars bar in Tesco's and that with the company credit card, pushes it overdrawn by whatever it costs for a king-size Mars bar, by a pound, you should disclose that. He pays it back, that's another disclosure. Does it again next week, you should disclose each one. That's what the Act says. So if you want to summarise it, I think that's sensible, don't get me wrong, but that is a concession. So you could potentially have someone say, or the next accountant or the client say, is that all right? And just know where you're coming from, know why you're doing what you're doing and what the law says. And of course, it is sensitive because it goes in the abbreviated accounts. Under this section of the Companies Act, you don't need to disclose the director's name. So maybe obvious if there's only one director, I appreciate. But in principle, this might not be as sensitive as you think because you don't have to disclose the names of the directors involved. Of course, the Frizzy and FRS 8 might say, well, we need to disclose the name for a material balance, but the Companies Act, not so much so. Where do you put it in your accounting software? You need to be a little bit careful because some people have told me if you follow the strict rules, in the abbreviated accounts, you'd have the advances and the repayments, but you'd have no opening and closing balance because that's not required. That's fallen out of the abbreviated accounts. And I think that just makes more of a mess. So I quite like the idea, as we've said, that, you know, you don't need the opening and closing balances, but might it just make it clearer? So I was talking to a client yesterday on a session we did, and he said, look, I've got a client and it's got the whole thing's a mess. I couldn't tell you when it was overdrawn and when it wasn't because he just used it like a current account. There must be hundreds of transactions. What do I do? And I said, in reality, I think if you just disclose everything by type of transaction, you hope that's good enough. So opening balance, closing balance, all the ins and all the outs, you know, classified by category. And I think that's probably enough. So that's perhaps more than you need because you might be disclosing transactions when it's not overdrawn. But hopefully by disclosing everything, you're going to satisfy anyone who looks at your accounts and is going to be picky. Okay, 2 minutes left then. I'll just introduce this final case study and then I'm conscious I'll have to stop in a minute. So you might want to have a look at this. We've put this case study in your notes, X Limited. There are some shareholders and some directors. And the rules really under FRS 8 and the Frizzy, they're not going to make much difference in this case study. Perhaps under the Frizzy, you could more likely say Jack and Jenny are not, Jack and Jill, they are not related parties because they're not close family of the director. If they are adult children who don't live with the director and have no contact with the company, actually, are they members of the same household? Are they close family? So that's why we've put some notes about what they do, professional footballer, poor student, Because we might need to look a little bit more and say, well, okay, Jack is a professional footballer. Does he really care about those shares? Does he care about his dad's business? He lives in his mansion. He drives a Bentley. He doesn't care. So, you know, I suppose he's close genetically, but actually in terms of being a member of the same household, in terms of having an influence over his father in the dealings with the entity, perhaps we can justify not. Jill is a student. Her money comes from John. She probably lives at home when she's not at university, so she's going to be close family of a director. She will be a related party. These are the kind of thought processes that you need. If you're auditing under FRS 8, I should say you need to look at the definitions of close family in FRS 8. FRS 8 just lists who's close family. So close family under FRS 8 is wife or domestic partner, your children, nothing about where they live or how old they are, your children and the children of your domestic partner. So FRS 8 is much more prescriptive about who is close family, and that's going to catch an awful lot more people. So that's why I say to people, the Frizzy's great. It's got simplified rules and it's going to have a lot less people covered. So if I move in with someone who has children, I may never have met the children. This lady's children may be adults. They may be in another country. They're close family under FRS 8, not under the Frizzy. Do you think that's 3 o'clock? Excellent. Okay, well, I hope I've rushed through the slides a little bit, but please do catch me in the coffee break if you'd like to ask any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks ever so much, David. Again, another excellent and thought-provoking presentation, and as well as being highly entertaining as well. It's always tricky to do this graveyard shift, I think, after lunch, but I didn't see many people nodding, if any, actually, and it was highly entertaining, and I think we can all take a lot away from this, and I suspect there'll be quite a few of us on Monday morning going through our procedures and disclosure checklists and just making sure we're all continuing to get it right. Okay, there's some refreshments being served now in the King's Lounge for the final time. And if all delegates, well, it says on here that there's a final slide saying where the next meetings are. Well, I can't see it there, but I'm sure you all know where you're going for the next session. If you can all be in your next rooms at 3:15 prompt for your final session. Thank you very much.